Welcome back to the Renaissance Foundation podcast, a podcast about inspiration made by the young people at our youth charity. We support young carers, hospital patients, and at-risk pupils in London. I'm Corey, a member of staff at Renaissance Foundation, and I'll be introducing today's episode. Just before we start, I wanted to say a massive thank you to all of the young people we support. Thank you for being part of RF and overcoming unprecedented challenges. Many of our young people have now gone back to school, started at a new school, college or uni, and some are unable to physically attend because they're shielding. We just want to say everyone is doing amazingly well and all of us at RF are so proud of every single one of you. We've got lots of exciting activities and opportunities planned, and although it's going to be different to our usual RF program, we're going to carry on inspiring young people living with significant challenges to achieve their full potential. Now to today's guest. This episode is longer than usual because we covered so much, it just felt best to share as much of the conversation as we could. We're extremely lucky to have the opportunity to speak to Wol Kolade. Wol Kolade is the managing partner of London-based private equity firm Living Bridge. They've just launched their 100 Black Interns campaign, which offers internships in finance to people of colour. He's also chairperson at Guy's and St Thomas's charity, non-executive director for NHS Improvement, and a trustee at Somerset House. Wol spoke to us openly about his journey growing up, discussing how it felt moving to the UK after living in multiple countries, going to boarding school, and also experiences he's encountered with racism and prejudice and the times that he's confronted that and why. It was a really open and frank discussion in which Wol took the time to share his insights from his life and career journey and also expertly answered our questions and gave our young people advice about future careers. Thank you for talking to us, Wol, sharing your wisdom and introducing us to the 100 Black Interns campaign. Thank you to all the young people that joined the discussion. Even if you didn't want to ask a question, the fact that you joined and listened to the podcast means the world to us. We're going to carry on making these podcasts as we want to inspire as many people as possible. But if you want to help us and the young people we support, please head over to our website where you can find out how to donate. We are a local charity and we make this podcast ourselves, so every donation makes a massive difference, not only to the podcast, but the program that we run for young people, especially that we've had to adapt it due to lockdown and COVID. It's going to really help us if you donate. Now, I'll hand over to our host, Nisha.
Hi, everyone. I'm Nisha. I'm the fundraising executive at Renaissance Foundation. Not saying my age at all, because, you know, we all know where I'm at that point where I just don't want to admit to it. My favorite subject at school, art, and my passion, I'm not going to say tie-dyeing this time. I'm going to say reading, because I've got some new books. And yeah, I'm going to nominate Sat to go next.
So I'm Sat. I run the CEO of Renaissance Foundation. My age is the wrong side of 30. My favourite subject was history. It's my passion. My favourite subject. And in my passion, I'm a very frustrated Arsenal fan. So.
Sorry, I wasn't muted then.
I'm a Liverpool fan. You know, laugh away.
So you're happy then, Wol, right? You had a good
evening. Well, yeah, a little bit. 30 years of pain.
So I'll nominate Corey next.
Hi, I'm Corey. I'm the media manager at Renaissance Foundation. I'm old enough to where if I need to use my ID for something, it's a compliment now. And I'm passionate about making media, making podcasts, making videos, and also what's been really nice is doing the music workshops like the one we just had before this. So I'm passionate about anything creative, and I'm going to nominate next Amani.
Hey guys, I'm Amani. I'm the outreach intern here at RF. I'm gonna skip the age question also. My favorite subject at school used to be maths, loved that, and my passion is most recently gardening. Yay. So I'll nominate Lydia to go next.
Hi, my name is Lydia. I'm 21, first one to admit my age. Favorite subject at school was biology and later in neuroscience in uni. Passion is dance throughout my life. And I will nominate Natalie.
Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie from the Renaissance Foundation, Director of Fundraising and Impact. I'm 1,000,000% not doing the age thing because not only am I the wrong side of 30, I think I'm the wrong side of 40. So keeping it very quiet. My favourite subject at school was English, and my passion is still, when I get the time, reading. But also actually spent a lot of time in my garden recently, which has been lovely. And while we've had a little bit of sunshine, it's been fantastic. So who am I going to nominate? Let me see who's left. I think, oh, Rachel, are you here still? Or shall I pass over to... Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I'm here. Hi, thank you so much for joining us today. My name's Rachel, and yeah, I'm going to skip the age. My favourite subject at school, I think it was math. And my passion is music, which is very exciting at the moment because we're working on a music project. And the next person I'm going to nominate, of Corey, have you been? Yeah. I'll go to Osei then.
Hi, I'm Osei. I'm 16. My favorite subject, all of the ones that I did for GCSE, those are my favorite, surprisingly. My passion, I really like music. I was able to go to the music workshop, which was a shame. But yeah, I would nominate, who hasn't gone yet?
Hi, I'm Kadisha. I'm 16. I'm passionate about music and making people smile. And that's it.
That's really good. And I think everyone has been introduced apart from our guest. So I'm going to hand it over to Wall to take it away.
Okay. So, hi, everyone. So Wall Collade is my name. I'm the right side of 50, as in over 50. Favourite subject, economics. And my passion, there's a good one. Films. Probably. And football, and flying, and music, quite a lot. Anyway, there we go. That's me. So I was going to talk to you a little bit about me and what I've done and how I've got to where I've got to and some of the things I've encountered along the way. And you know, try to give you a sense of how I've gone about overcoming it, and whether that's an example for you, I don't know, but I hope it's something that will give you some support if you ever encounter issues, that you can get through them and you can, despite everything, make a success of your situation. Particularly when, you know, for me, it was a pretty unlikely dream, in that I'm doing the job I wanted to do when I was 14. So I set out when I was 14 to become someone who's involved in my line of work, which is private equity, and that's a particular part of finance, which I'll explain in a second. And, you know, back then it seemed very unlikely because not only were there very few people who did it, there were very few people of colour who did it, and very few black people who did it. In fact, back then there was only one when I joined the industry out of a few thousand people. So how did I get to that point? What attracted me to private equity? Why was I interested in this rather arcane part of finance? Well, the story goes back to sort of how I grew up and what I find fascinating. So I'm Nigerian by birth, although having been born in Nigeria, my father was a diplomat, so I ended up traveling quite a lot. From the age of, I think, one, I left Nigeria, and we went to live in the Cameroons. And then from there, we went to, let's say, Cameroons. Then after a few years in the Cameroons, we went to the US. I lived in Washington, D.C. And I have, I don't know if I believe this or not, my mother tells me it's true, but I apparently went to President Nixon's, one of his grandchildren's birthday parties at the White House. Of course, I have no memory of this because I was so young, but there's my sort of claim to fame. I haven't been to the White House, but not actually ever remembering it. So we're in the US, and that was very interesting. Then from the US, we moved to the West Indies. So I lived in Trinidad and Tobago for many years, Port of Spain, which I remember much, much more clearly because I moved there when I was 7 and a half, going on 8. I lived there for 4 or 5 years. And the joy about being there was we were sort of traveling between the islands. So you start from Trinidad and Tobago, and then we'd go to Barbados, Antigua, all the way up to Jamaica. And it was a lot of fun. Having said all that, the one problem with growing up like that is that you end up having to make friends again every time you move country. And you sort of tend to end up not being rooted anywhere. And if you follow through the logic of where I started, my first language is actually French, because the Cameroons is French. And the system of education was French. Okay, that age didn't matter. Then I moved to America. In America, you don't even go to kindergarten until you're 7. So that, you know, the sort of nursery school education I was getting was basically playing. And then I arrived in the West Indies, which is basically English. I was way behind because, of course, you know, they start people educating much in terms of serious work much, much earlier on. And my parents decided it'd be a good idea to have me in one system rather than many. And they chose England. So I went to boarding school from the age of 8. And I started with my brother, and then I was on my own, actually. That was a really interesting experience. Imagine coming from a very protected sort of background where, and actually relatively, if I'm honest, relatively privileged background, where you're insulated from any sort of, commentary about the colour of your skin. I wasn't really aware of it, quite honestly, until I arrived in England in 1974. And, you turn up at this boarding school, then there was two black children out of about 300 boys. And, children are extraordinary in that for sometimes very good reason, they initially focus on differences. And I was clearly very different to what they were expecting. And that was fine. And in a sense, it didn't worry me because we were just explaining a little bit. What worried me was the teachers who really focused on differences and who were really quite unsympathetic and lacking understanding. They're supposed to be there to support you. Let me tell you, back then, there was no sort of support, no sort of help. Comments like, well, of course, that's because you're black, or it's because you come from such and such a place, or, well, whatever. And even sort of to the point where, well, you're black, you're quite tall, you must be a fast runner. So going, well, what if I'm not? What if I'm not good at sport? What if I don't like the sport they're trying to teach me? That never really occurred to them. It was just a very much stereotypical view. And again, the surprise was, I grew up watching American TV, really, both in the West Indies and in the US. And that's a lot of cartoons and Sesame Street. Sesame Street was a very supportive program in the way it depicted everything. And then they're all way, way too young to remember these programs. But I remember staying with my uncle who lives in town. He's my guardian in the UK. And watching a program called Love Thy Neighbor. And Love Thy Neighbor was basically the premise was you had a black couple and a white couple. And the white couple and the white guy and the black guy worked together in a sort of, industrial setting. And it was all about how they weren't really friends, but they interacted together. And, he used a lot of basically derogatory language, which was apparently funny. Why was I watching that program? I mean, we watched it bizarrely because let's say there were 10 shows in a series. On the one show, the black guy would get it over on the white guy. And you basically watched it for that. The rest of the time, it was sort of funny, but not really. It was actually really quite painful. But that was on ITV. That was just the context we were operating in. And again, that was pretty shocking if you grew up in a really sheltered environment. So it's quite a rude awakening. And then I should speed up here, actually, because basically I spent too long in my childhood. But it was quite instructive. So and again, I remember traveling up from school and going to my uncle who lived in Finsbury Park and being, you come out from this lily white, really speaking, private school. And you emerge into Finsbury Park in the late 70s. There were riots, rape fires. It was quite a sort of scary place to be in many respects. And I remember coming home with my backpack, everything on my back, and being stopped and searched by the police. And what they couldn't understand was my accent. Like, what the hell are you taking the piss? I'm going, no, that's just how I speak. They must be taking the piss. Why do you talk like that? And you know, it was a really, and that in a sense, I'm focusing on the stupidity things because actually it was quite a scary circumstance being confronted by three or four cops and having your backpack taken over, put against the wall, everything taken out. But it was a weird time. And actually, I had this sort of contrast of that. And then you sort of arrive at school, which is very different and a very protected environment. Anyway, in talking to my parents about this, particularly my father was very fortunate. And again, he went to Durham University, but in the 50s. Now, you can imagine being a black person in Durham in the 1950s. I mean, it was brutal, is a sure answer. And I remember saying something very, very straightforward. He said, look, well, it's about what you want to achieve and just focus on that goal. And let me tell you, his words, you can do anything you want. You can be anything you want. Don't anyone ever tell you anything different. But maybe, and this is just how the game is played, you have to work three times as hard as everyone else together. Now, you know, I remember saying, well, why? He goes, well, because you're black. I said to him, well, that's unfair. He goes, well, yeah, but that's the rules. And I said, well, who made the rules? And he said, you're living in a circumstance which is very, is set up against you. That doesn't mean you have to be a victim of that. And again, I'm talking about the 80s and 70s when a lot of what we understand now and the approach is just was not there. You know, the things which they thought acceptable, just, you know, you would be, even the most aggressive, underground racist would find it difficult to express themselves in that way they used to back then. But again, you know, I took that on board and it really helped me because he then also said, it's less, you know, if you start to internalize it and react, then it becomes your problem. Basically, they are lacking education, lacking in self-respect, and lacking in understanding as human beings. That is their problem, not yours. And I got told this at a very early age, so 13, 14. And I remember being in economics class discussing various different things. And this thing, private equity, which is working with companies and investing in them, came up. And I remember thinking, that's what I want to do. Now, don't ask me why, but it's about being with entrepreneurial people who make things, create things. Now, I'm not that creative, but what I do is help them to do what they want to do. And there's been, you know, that's how we get new things. So, you know, Apple was backed by a venture capital company, you know, Google, et cetera, et cetera. It's how we create new things. We back these extraordinary entrepreneurs who have a view. That's basically my day-to-day job. And back then, it was no one did it, or very few people did it. And also, virtually no minorities were involved in it. It was such a rarefied part of finance. And I remember sort of trying to figure out how I got into it. And the answer was there was no particular route. I ended up going to university, doing engineering, and then I tried to get in. And every door slammed in my face. And I remember I then said, okay, well, maybe I just need to get into finance in general. And I was with my colleagues, you know, friends from university, we were all applying. And I was finding that every time I applied, I wasn't getting any interviews. And I'll never forget, in the end, I applied to 35 different companies, got two interviews and one job. My peers, who were white, replied to three, or maybe four. Two interviews, one job. And I just remember thinking, why does that work for me? That's really, really unfair, isn't it? But then I thought, hang on, focus on your goal. My goal is to get into private equity. And I always think, you know, occasionally in life, you get to punctuation points, as I call them, where you've got a direction of travel that way or that way, a choice, a fork in the road. And sometimes you're being sort of guided towards different things, and that helps you to the next stage, next stage, next stage. And so the company I joined, I didn't actually want to join. I joined Barclays because it was the only job I had an offer. I was thinking, I just don't want to be there. And anyway, as luck would have it, I ended up working for a really interesting guy because I was in their graduate program, who was in many ways extraordinary because he was, I learned so much from him. And I learned so much from him that helped me in later life. I remember when I was offered the chance to work for him, I didn't want to work for him because the title was PA to the city director. I said, I don't want to be PA.
I mean, I wanted someone's personal assistant and carrying a bag. And I turned it down. And anyway, he called me up. He said, I hear you turned my job down. I was offering you. I said, yes. He goes, do you know anything about it? I said, well, you know, I don't want to be your assistant. I'm really sorry. I want to do a proper job. And he said, this is a proper job. And he said, by the way, when we finish, you're going to love it. And we'll get on really well. I went, and he went, trust me. And it was that classic fork in the road. I decided to trust him. And, you know, to this day, he's still a friend of mine, even though he's much older now. He taught me so much, which we haven't got time to go into now. Anyway, from that, I sort of said to him, you know, he's quite a senior guy, so I'm going to get into private equity. He said, well, let me help you. And through his offices, I got, because I couldn't get there directly, I got another job. It was a stepping stone, slightly over to the left over here, but helped me to then move across into where I wanted to be. So really quite quickly, I ended up being in private equity at quite a young age. And it was 1993. So the UK was in recession. It was quite a difficult place to be, but I was where I wanted to be. And then actually, again, I ended up working for an individual who was fascinating. A man back then who, because it was still quite aggressive, you know. And remember, in private equity, we have the money and we want to invest in someone's company. So you're always interacting with this, the managing director or the big shareholders. And now I'm sort of 26-year-old, black guy in Blackburn at Slinger's Quality Meats. Blackburn, did I say Blackburn? Was it Blackburn? No, it's just outside Blackburn. In my sort of city suit, walking around the place. And what they did was to basically make the meat for mince meat for Sainsbury's and Tesco's. So you had these huge tattooed guys with skinheads, basically slicing up the meat, putting it in the grinder. And Graham was like, well, of course, we're going to tour the factory. I'm like, no, I don't think so. He's like, no, we have to. And it was a pretty scary, scary situation where you're in this factory with probably 100 guys with knives who really were looking at you, and they will stop work as they walk through. And what the hell is this guy doing here? And it wasn't until the managing director of the company essentially treated me with respect, and they were like, what just happened? And I learned a really interesting lesson there, which is, you know, I could have been intimidated. I could have deviated from what my job is, which is to focus on what I'm trying to get done, which is to help this guy build a better company. Or I could have sort of backed off and I would have sort of diminished my career, if you like. Another situation was when the managing director of a company we're trying to get involved with, he was in many respects, he was an okay guy, right? I mean, you know, he was older, in his 50s, I'm 26, 27. My boss is in his 40s. We're trying to help this guy buy his company from the owners. And he's chosen our firm to help him. And he decided it'd be funny to refer to me, not by my name, but by a sort of derogatory racial term, all the time. So whenever I walked in, he'd go, oh, there's such and such. And my boss would just be beside himself with embarrassment, but didn't do anything, didn't say anything. And so initially, sort of smile, huh? Yeah. But this was a 3-month process. I probably interacted with this guy 30, 40 times. I'm trying to help him get rich. And his joke was to just keep doing this over and over and over again, in front of his other colleagues, in front of the lawyers, in front of the accountants, in front of, you know, the owners. It was really, really awful. And anyway, what did I do? I did what I know many of you will have done in the past when you're presented sometimes this sort of stuff, which is you essentially just suck it up, don't you? And you just go, if I make a noise now, what will I actually achieve in this circumstance, in this time, in the context I'm in? And actually, that was one of the few times, some once or twice, not quite as overt as that, not over such a long period, where actually you end up going, no, I'm going to, this is going to be fine. I'm going to focus on this job and just not rise to it. Now, here's the moral of the story, right? Which I don't tell many people, but a few years later, the company wasn't doing so well. By which time I'm more senior. I'm actually looking after this company for my private equity firm. I had to fire that guy. Right? And I remember the look on his face. He couldn't compute. There was no appealing to me because it had just completely turned. And in fact, for him, his world had completely shifted. And to his credit, he went, I prayed pretty badly, didn't I, back then? Well, yeah, you did. That's not why we're firing you. We're firing you because you're rubbish. Yeah. So again, you know, fork in the road. And actually, for me, it was such a powerful moment. I'm not saying revenge is sweet. It wasn't revenge. It really wasn't revenge at all. Because as I said, I was very explicit with him. It's got nothing to do with our relationship. I don't care. It's because you're not good at your job. That's why you've been fired. But for him, he had no ally. He had behaved with such arrogance. And actually, it was typical of his approach that meant he ended up and ultimately not failing and being moved on. Now, I'm sort of going to finish up now to give you some last questions. But, you know, I've ended up really being very fortunate to work with some extraordinary people, both in my company, people we've done investments with, and we've done very well. And I can't deny that. But part of it has just been through focusing on hiring and being with people who've got talent, not worrying about what other people think, just focusing on what we want to do. And sometimes it's a lonely furrow to plow, but actually you've ended up being proven right. And it's having that courage and your convictions that I think with my experience back then has helped. Also making a virtue of the difference. So I had to raise money from people who give us money to invest. So pension funds, whatever, insurance companies. And that's how the model works. Insurance companies give us money. We then put it to work. Having made the work, we go back to them. And if we do well, it continues. But the going around asking for money is quite fun. And, you know, I go to America, which is basically a place that holds all money, basically. And I go there, myself and a Jewish lady go and do the fundraising together. And we meet all these people. And, you know, we sometimes laugh because you go to sort of, you know, Durham in South Carolina or wherever it is. North Carolina. Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. And you know, this is South, right? Jewish lady, black guy, pension fund. We're not getting any money here. But we do it anyway, right? And it's just quite amusing that actually they're very polite. No one ever says anything. And we're really good at what we do, right? And we walk over zero. Now, that's, you might say, well, that's really unfair. Flip side. You go to California or New York, where they have as much money, if not more. The fact that you are black and a Jewish woman turning up is such a refreshing thing compared to all the sort of, you know, pale white male they see. You stand out so much that you get more focus and raise tons of money. Now, again, you might say, well, is that fair? It's not fair. Well, actually, it's the world, right? And the danger with the way that the whole racism thing has moved is you're moving away from the overt, direct, in your face to, I think the phrase is microaggression, systemic, insidious. Oh, you're not quite right because you've got the right attitude. If only they were better at this, that, and the other. But we've got a fair approach to this, haven't we? Or the trivial stuff. If you know, the number of times I've sitting here in the city, in the old days, because of course these days they can't afford it, when I'm hearing a black cab and the number that just keep going past, or switch that light off for a minute and see me. And you know what I do? I say, fine. The cab that takes me, I literally, because I can, double the tip or more. Because I want that person to go, shit, I picked this black guy up. You wouldn't believe the tip I got. right? And again, a lot of them work around the same area. I don't know if it moved the dial. I don't know if it helped the next guy who, but you just want to change the dynamic of how they think and what they think. Or if I go to a restaurant, they start messing me around. I just start the uncomfortable conversation of, no, that tip's not good enough. Why? What's next to the kitchen? It's the only tip we have. Oh, it's not, is it? It is the only tip we have, sir. I go, well, there's that free. And I go, well, no, that's someone else. I go, who? Show me. At which point, it's my table. Because, of course, what they expect people to do is not have the uncomfortable conversation of, I know what you're doing. Don't do it. I'm not going to tolerate it. Now, that's great if I'm fighting on my own. And a lot of my colleagues say, well, what can we do? I go, it's simple. The way you see and live your life is different to the way I see and live my life, even though I'm your boss. If you see other people, and I can afford it, quite honestly, I've achieved a level of success where, frankly, I can be quite aggressive myself if I need to be to get what I want. Just remember, if you see other colleagues who are not able to fight for themselves, you have to do the fighting. You have to stand shoulder to shoulder with them to face down this insidious microaggression crap that goes on and not tolerate it. Look at it through a different lens. If you want to have an impact, do that right away. And stop assuming that there's a sort of reasonable reason why the cab keep on going back. Oh, because they're going off on work. I'm going, it happens every day. You know, every day you say, they all go, no, come on. You know, that's what you've got to do, or rest, or sort of uncomfortable situations. And you have to, as a person who is in the white privilege camp, be prepared to have the conversation to help you understand what it's like and how life is and the context we live in if you're non-white. And I do subscribe very heavily to that whole approach of, you know, my mother-in-law, who's white, is, you know, she describes herself and has done as, I'm sort of colorblind. And I go, Suzanne, that's kind of not really enough. You know, because it's easy. You're sort of white middle class. Of course you can be colorblind. Good for you. You have to go the extra mile. You have to be anti-racist, not just, I'm not racist. You can't share that lived experience, but what you can do is empathize and be bothered to empathize and to sort of ask for help and direction and to actually try to see the world through that different lived experience and start with the perspective of, I'm white, so I start with the privilege. Privilege of, I don't think about where I travel. I don't think about where I go. I don't think about what I do. Now look at it through, I think about where I travel. I think about what I do. I think about where I go. How's your life feel? Actually, it's quite stressful if you let it get to you. That's what being anti-racist is about. So do I think things have got better? Of course they have. Do I think they got worse? Well, in different ways, yes. Do I think there's an equal opportunity for everyone to actually make this better? Absolutely. But responsibility is on people of color as well, you know. We have to allow the conversations. We have to provide the bridge. And if you, yes, of course you can be aggressive, you can be angry, and you can be, I mean, of course, people suffer all the time. And I'm not saying that's not legitimate. Of course it is. The issue is that, you know, in Britain, the white population is, I'm going to get it wrong, but 83%, 84%, give or take. You know, that's why we're all called ethnic minorities. In all things to improve, they have to give something up. Right? If you want to take it by force or through aggression, good luck. Because there's so many more people to convince. If you can educate, build that bridge, it may take longer, but it'll be more sustainable and be given freely. That's what I'm after. And that's in a sense why I sort of work with the system to point out and to help them find a way, a bridge across to our side, so they can understand and be willing to give up some of the aspects of the privilege that they have. That's my 25 minutes rather than 10. I do apologize.
No, that was amazing. So many like different little bits of nuggets of information. And I think we're all just sitting here like, wow, where do we even begin? But yeah, if does anyone have any questions? I know we're all probably in that same, like, still processing and everything. But if you do, just unmute yourselves and ask. If not, I can start. So my question, Wal, is going through all these experiences and then looking back, what would you tell your younger self?
it's kind of worth it. I think what I tell my younger self. So I would probably tell my younger self to have been more open with people about what I was going through, because I almost had like a double life in that, you know, you kind of compartmentalize, you take the experiences you had that were negative, all race bound, if you like, and rather than talk to your colleagues and friends about them, who are all mostly white, you just park it and forget about it. So in a sense, I was living for a long time, not my whole self was not being brought to everything. And so the shock when people sort of go, oh my God, you've got racism. Dude, you're what? Of course. That I might have found a little, and then you wouldn't have sort of kept it with you. It would have been a weight internally. So that's probably what I would have said.
It's really good advice. Does anyone else want to? Yeah, Sat?
Yeah, first I wanted to say thank you, Wal, because that a lot of what you said could really resonate, I think, with a lot of us. And I appreciate you kind of sharing that with us, because it's such a personal experience when we all face these things. And it's happened more than once where we've faced them very microaggression issues, and yeah, it's been, and you, I think we've taken the approach that, like you said, sometimes you just let it slide and trying to but it's something that you've experienced, and you know, and like you said, so you know, it's trying to understand it and process it, and but it's definitely something that we've experienced for sure, and very recently as well, so it's definitely still going on. But one of the questions I was going to want to ask you was about of everything that's going on at the moment as well. Sort of for sort of the young people on the call and the ones who are listening as well on the podcast and stuff. Like, what advice would you give them about kind of moving this forward as well? Are there things that we can do? And you said like education and building that bridge, and can we build that bridge? How can we make it a positive action in a way, or, you know?
I think it's about holding people to account, actually. And by holding people to account, I'm not talking about just the government, because you can hold people to account one person at a time. But that holding people to account, to explain this, it's about yourself as well. So if I'm going to be angry and not explain why I'm angry, then I'm not really helping, okay? If I'm going to be hurt and hurting because of my small but significant repetitive, you know, go to supermarket, help me find something, I don't work here, like the 10th time. Little things like that, or your experience in the tennis club. Hold yourself to account to have the conversation, even though it's uncomfortable. Hold them to account so they can understand. Because if you don't do that, we won't move forward. The second thing is, I think that you then can move up a level to the system, and looking at points in the system that are, a friend of mine calls it kinks in the hose pipe, okay, and trying to untangle or undo the kinks, smooth them out. And you can do that by being clearer about and understanding the data around things. So let me unpack this. I'm chairman of a charity, a big one, that has you know, been involved in the slavery statue business, which is, of course, very, very emotional, very, very difficult in many respects, not all, but many. And, you know, we have a statue outside Guy's Hospital of a guy who basically founded us 500 years ago. Now, forget all the good that's happened since. Let's just go back to that issue. Standing there, should he be a person celebrated, even though he made a lot of his money that he gave through slavery? And I've had incoming from both ways, lots of it. I've gone, okay, what we need to do
is the work properly? I'm not going to respond without clear knowledge. So the first thing is we need to un-airbrush the history, okay, and explain that there is an issue here which we're going to be looking at. Forget that we are doing lots of good, but we need to make it legitimate to have a conversation. And then when you do the work properly, and what I've done is gone, we will respond clearly, not give you a soundbite, when we've done the work. And here's the work, it's transparent. Here's who's doing the work. Here's why, it's a range of views. And at that point, then we'll talk about it properly. Too often, what people do is just rush into it, and then they become undone, or they hijack it for their own particular agenda. The answer to this is, different people suffer from different things. Race is a key element in many respects, but so is, deprivation, health, well-being, family situation, context to culture, context. This is a complex mix. So reducing it too much too quickly, I think, is really, we're doing ourselves a disservice in the long run. So for me, it's think it through, do the work properly, as well as this whole legitimize the conversation, be happy to be a bit uncomfortable. And I'm talking about both ways. You're uncomfortable having a conversation, they're uncomfortable having a conversation. Because until you legitimize it properly, you won't have a conversation.
Really good advice. Thank you.
Thank you. That's been really interesting, what you've been discussing. And there's so many levels to it. And one key part that I've picked up on the discussion is when you went into the field of work and being so young with so much responsibility, so having that age barrier. We've got some young people that are like leaving school and then one that's in university as well. And I wonder if those guys have any questions about their careers and any advice. So we've got Ananya, Ose and Kadisha. Do you guys have any questions you'd like to ask? Oh, I see Ananya, you've got your hand up.
Thanks, Corey. Hi, Wall. Thank you for joining us today. I'm at university, and I was interested to hear your story about being offered the seat at at a restaurant near the kitchen. And I wanted to ask, at what point did you feel like you had the confidence to be able to challenge those kinds of that kind of authority, even if it is the waiter at your restaurant?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. So actually, from a very young age, and then I sort of slipped back. So when I was on my own, fine, I was just happy to have the conversation. Then I got married and, you're going there with your wife and with your kids, and it's like, please don't make a scene. And for a while, I just went, you know what, whatever. And then I sort of went, you know what, no, sorry, this is not real me. This is not who I am. I'm sorry, both my colleagues and my family just have to deal with it. Because I need to send a message and have that message reinforced over and over again, such that then I'm making it better for the next person who turns up. So they don't immediately go, or put it this way, if they do it all the time, they just know they're going to get grief. So just don't do it. but if none of us do anything, then nothing happens. But no, great question. From the very beginning, which was painful, because you don't have the sort of wherewithal to sort of understand. But then, I spent a lot of time understanding, and I worked in a restaurant. I worked as a bar person at the university. You know what's going on, right? And it's just a question of playing that back to them. But I fell into that trap of not wanting to have the uncomfortable conversation for a few years.
Thank you.
Do we have any more questions? We've got time for about two more.
Hi, well, thank you so much for that amazing talk. I think it's going to be really inspirational for our young people. And I know a few of them couldn't make it today, but this is the lovely thing about recording this session, because we can kind of play this and use it as an education tool for some of the young people, which will be incredible. Recently, we had a session regarding Black Lives Matter, and the reason why we did that was because we wanted to raise awareness of the microaggressions that can happen within schools. And we thought through these small acts is actually how teachers can best see how they can change their attitudes towards some of the pupils, and could Kadisha's gone now, but Osei, who's on the call, was also a part of that. And we all kind of shared experiences, and we will kind of use that now to kind of highlight for safeguarding issues also, but then within the schools. So this talk is amazing. So thank you for that. I just wanted to ask, it seems as though you're very skilled at choosing when to pick your battles. and I just wondered how you've managed that, how you've let some things go, and when you've known how to challenge, and whether you could help the young people understand times that they should challenge and times when perhaps they do need to make some of the sacrifices that you had to when you knew you were experiencing racism.
Look, the challenge and sacrifice, let's get context here, is not in any way life-threatening. You know, so I would say there's certain situations where you just have to be safe and sensible about this. These are sort of the sort of microaggression sort of challenges which we're talking about, some more overt than others. And it's about deciding which battles to fight and how they would take you towards your goal. So the first thing, I was extremely clear what I want to achieve. And that was really helpful because it helped to give me the context of this battle is just not worth fighting. Because, you know, if I lose it, I'll go further back. If I don't win it, I'll just stay where I am. Right? There's actually there's no upside in it. And so that, you know, it's being a little bit calculating and going, there's just no upside in this. There's lots of downside. So why bother? And you sort of let it go. And a friend of mine describes it as just sort of water off a duck's back and you don't move on. But there are other battles which are sort of fundamental to, if you're going to block my path towards my goal, then I'm going to have to fight, right? Because now you're really interfering with what I want to do. And so sometimes you may not have that fight there and then, but it's always logged, and I come back to it. So, you know, go back, I mean, being brutally honest about my interaction with that racist, he wasn't racist, he just an idiot, really. CEO who was, you know, calling me names as we did the deal. You know, my bet partly was, at some point, I'm gonna have the opportunity to have a proper conversation with him, where the boot's on my other foot. And it happened. And it happened because I was actually, you know, running the business. My director had gone, and quite an early age, I got given the opportunity to run the business. So I was able to then deliver, and he had nowhere to go. So I think choose your battles carefully, understand what you were trying to do and where you're trying to go. On a sort of personal level, where it's the little things, I think you can do it with respect, actually. And you may not get what you want, but you'll make your point. You know, if I go to a restaurant and they're misbehaving, you go, I know what you're doing. And you explain why you know what they're doing. And you let them try and persuade you not doing it. And doing it in a calm, not an angry way, makes them, depending on who they are, they'll probably stay with them, actually. You know what I mean? So it's just you draw the line in the sand. And you say, I'm accepting this, even though I know what you're doing. And you know what you're doing. And next time I come here, I won't take it. But for now, I will. Sort of approach. You can still do it without having the fight. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's so helpful. And I really think that it will resonate with everyone here, especially the young people. I think Osei has a question. And Ananya, do you have time to take two more questions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, fab. Osei, would you like to say your question out loud? I think that's a no.
isn't it?
Yes, it is. Can you see it?
So let me see. I'll look at the chat. The chat says, how do you recognize overt racism? Usually because they're calling you names. They are flagrantly disregarding the quality of what you've done. They are not allowing you access purely because of how you look. And, you know, we all feel it, right? And it's not a if you're a person of colour, you feel it. You know, sorry, what? Why can't I come in before? Sorry, why? You know, you don't look for, I'll be with for later on. Or, you know, I'm trying to buy something and some guy's pointing, you know, can I help you? You know, so that profiling nonsense goes on. Recognizing it's not hard. The hard bits are dealing with it, and dealing with it in a way that doesn't escalate into nonsense. Great question. Overreacting. So my wife says I overreact, or used to say overreact. Like she tried to explain what's going on to her. So the other day, so I live in a very nice building, apartment building in London. And I was coming in with some parcels, and the desk, the concierge desk, a woman I'd never seen before, sprints out, says, "You're in the wrong place. Delivery's around the back, please leave." I was like, "Sorry, what?" At which point, another concierge person I know actually turned up and he went, "Oh, Mr. Collade, how can we help? Sorry, you've got stuff with it. He's taking the things off me." This woman could have died on the spot, actually. And I gave the story to my wife and she was like, "Well, that's, you know," she probably didn't know. I go, "No, that's profiling, right?" She made her mind up before I'd even said a thing, right? And what did I do? I said to her, "You don't know me, do you? We've never met." And, you know, the other guy just took the parcels up to my apartment for me. And she was looking and going, "I've completely miscalculated." And I go, "Yeah, you have. But you'll see him every day." So my wife was like, "That was over the top." I went, "No, she will never do that again." Right? That is the point. She'll remember that story and never do it again. Never be so overt in her approach and her profiling, her sort of suppositions. Because you just don't know. Now, I do know what happened. This is the final point of the story. Because I own the penthouse. And the guy I know went to her, "You have just ruined our Christmas bonus." No, he haven't. But they were furious with her. Great.
Wow. Thank you. I think, I know we're almost done, but I think, Anand, you had a question as well.
Sorry. I'll try to keep it quick. But I read that you are chairperson of the British Private Equity and Venture Capital Association, and those are industries that I'm quite interested in. And it seems to be, like, speaking from peers, quite a lot about who you know in especially venture capital, and it's quite notorious for being very homogenous. And speaking of picking your battles, what would your advice be on investing yourself in going through for these career trajectories, even though you probably likely have to spend a lot more time networking and so on?
The whole private equity thing, venture capital thing, is a campaign, okay? Because even if you had all the right credentials, getting into it's quite difficult. Having said that, there's a special problem being that there's not enough people of color involved in the sector, and in venture capital in particular, actually, both the people who receive the money and the people who give the money. And I know that there are plans afoot, partly because I'm involved in them, to change that dynamic. Because, you know, one of the responses to the BLM issues and the George Floyd horrific murder, so everyone goes, "Oh, what can we do about this? We've got to do something right now. Let's hire some black talent." Great, where is it? It isn't there. In venture capital, if you said tomorrow, "I want to hire 50 people," there just would not be people enough to hire. And so the point is, we've gone, "Oh, maybe we need to invest in this, create that pipeline by providing the internships, the support system, the work, dedicated pools to allow people in, such that actually, one, you get to know people and find out whether it's for you or not. And two, you're better equipped to make the grade when it comes to pitching for a job. You know, and so we are well on our way. I would encourage you, we're launching it in September. We have 100 internships for people starting next summer with 100 firms who've all signed up to take one person and pay them for the 6 weeks of their internship and give them a good sense of what it's about. And they'll repeat it the following year. And then maybe in 10 years' time, we'll have a very nice talent pool. Somebody say, I want to hire 10 people. We can actually do it. So I wouldn't give up. And there are definite moves afoot to do this. Not just here, it's the civil service. There's lots of places trying to respond. Find one of those. Find an avenue through that route to get in. And if you don't know, Sat, you got my details, let me know and I'll see what I can do.
That's really promising. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I know we've all taken so much away from this. So I think if we can all unmute ourselves and give a round of applause to all, that would be amazing.
Thank you. Thanks very much for listening. And I hope it's helpful. And, you know, I wish you all the very, very best in future careers and life.
Honestly, well, if we had a bit more time, and by a bit more, I mean a couple more hours more, so many more questions at you. But thank you for taking just this little bit to talk to us. And I think our CEO's got like the last question that we'll just round up on. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks. And sorry, we know time's limited, but it's been really inspiring. Like Corey was saying, we could have had 2 hours with you. I just wondered, I've seen a lot of your interviews online. You talk a lot about the future and AI and the future of jobs. And, you know, as a youth charity, we're trying to inspire young people. Yeah. And on the TV, we're seeing a lot of negative news about redundancies and, you know, things like that. Could you give us any positive inspiration about where young people can try and focus?
This is so straightforward, okay? So the problem we have is, yes, you know, coronavirus has caused damage to our economy. It's very difficult for young people to get involved, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is, look at what we're doing. We're on Zoom. We've accelerated ourselves into the future of what technologies could be delivering. You know, if you'd asked me at the beginning of the year, you know, the level of penetration this stuff was having, it would take 10 years. But we're there already. We're on the cusp of this digital revolution that people think is happening and think has already happened. It's barely even started. Okay. We've got this amazing new world opening to us with things like AI, or really machine learning, advances in medicine, advances in terms of things like blockchain, all these what they call general purpose technologies that transform the way we live. So electricity was a general purpose technology. Today, we've got five of them happening at the same time, and that's just never happened before. And the opportunities are immense. The one entry ticket is digital skills, right? That's the language of the future. Everyone, my shorthand is everyone should learn how to program. Okay, not so you can write programs, but so you understand what they mean. So you understand how things are basically structured. So you have that stake in the future. Even if this is how a computer really, what's in this box computer thing? There's a thing fast, there's a chip, why is it put together like that? And what happens when it moves faster? What do I mean by AI, machine learning? And how can I do them simply? I'll give you one example. So, you know, AI, machine learning, artificial general intelligence, machine learning, two fundamental different things. We are so far from AI, it's barely worth even worrying about, right? It's just, you know, if we ever get there. Machine learning looks like magic, right? But machine learning is just huge amounts of computer power used to do a really simple thing. So I liken it to, you know, that classic, a computer recognizes a picture. And that's like taking a crane to move a feather. Literally, it is so utterly inefficient. But again, understanding that is really important. Understanding that it's not magic. And understanding that you can find your path and way there through this. I think young people have an advantage, actually, because they grew up with all this. You know, I grew up and my first job in private equity, we had one computer for 25 people. We had to book time to share it. You know, with Internet of Things coming, with electric cars, with driverless cars on motorways, etc., there's just a huge need for people to be part of this new economy. And we've launched ourselves into it at a rate of knots that will create jobs for people who have the skills.
Thank you.
Hope that helps. I love computers, actually. I love technology. But everyone should as well.
That's amazing advice to give to us. And I think it's a really nice positive note to end on, because it's got us thinking about the future and taking on all the knowledge that you've shared. So I just want to do a big round of applause, like Nisha said before. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
What did everyone think? That was just, I'm still like, there was so much in there. I'm still processing.
It was, I think what really was powerful was when he's telling these terrible stories and terrible ways, it's just so matter of fact, like he's reading a children's story. And I find that is so powerful, hearing that. And I don't know how he's not exhausted or angry. I mean, I'm sure he's all those things, but that quiet power of, let me tell you what this has been like, it was just, yeah, really powerful, really, really powerful stuff. Great choice of speaker.
And how did you find a bit about advice about getting into the industry, Ananya? Did that sound interesting?
Yeah, so I knew that the venture capital thing, like the stats are so scary on it. And like the other day I was reading, there's more people called Dave than there are women in C-suite places in the FTSE 100. Something like only 1% of VC funding goes to black founders, even though they make up 10% of companies, which is like a tenfold discrepancy. And it's like, am I spending all this time being on the venture capital society at university? Like, is that going to be like a massive waste? So it's that kind of like picking your battles decision. But like, I don't want, yeah, it was just interesting to hear his advice on it, because it's not like it's not doable, as in he's done it. So
I think you asked a really good question, Ananya. It was really nice that you could join. And I think hopefully that advice is like super beneficial to you. I'm happy that you asked that. And then obviously, I know you was a bit nervous on the mic before, but are you still here? You can say hello. What did you think about your answer? Because you asked really good questions as well. Got some really honest, truthful answers. What did you think about that?
Well, the reason I was quiet when everyone was shouting in my house. Anyway, yeah, because I asked that because this, I feel like, because it's so low-key, even though, like, so if you do mention it, it seems like you're overreacting, even though you clearly see there's something wrong there. And so I just wanted to know, like, how he dealt with that, you know what I mean?
I think it was really nice that you asked that and got such a nice answer. I just feel like there was so much that we could take away from that. Like we said, there was talking about, like, prejudice in terms of, like, racial issues and just dealing with racism, but like we said before, the ageism as well, going between the different cultures. I feel like we're going to need to get him back. What would you ask if he came back, if we could have a whole another hour? Is there anything that was missed out? And that goes to both of you, Ananya and Ose.
I was fascinated that someone just called him racist names when they were funding his company, like. And no one spoke up or were like, it blows my mind. I think it also would have been interesting to see his take on the intersection of like class, because he went to a private boarding school, and then he said that was a bubble in itself. So it, as in, he implying that it was a lot worse outside, but I'd imagine the stories inside the sort of public school would have been interesting to hear.
So thanks just everyone for taking part. It was just, I couldn't say thank you enough to everyone. Everyone smashed it. The questions were perfect. Nisha, you introduced the whole podcast. Like, literally, you're the best host. Now, like, we need to get you a proper, like, headset and microphone, because it's just, like, second nature to you now.
Yeah, everyone did so well. But yeah, is there like, do we want to like summarize maybe one piece of advice or something that we took away from the session?
I can start. I really found what he said about that being calm when you're being when someone's telling you that you're overreacting. That is, it's something that, yeah, it must be so hard. Like, to, that is like the last thing that you want to do in that situation. And hearing him, he's such a calm person in general, even like you were saying, Natalie, just retelling all those experiences, that, yeah, it's really impressive.
I thought his advice on being prepared to have uncomfortable conversations was really useful, because as long as they're not harmful or offensive, they don't cost you anything, and they're usually quite productive.
I think for me is when you're talking about picking your fights and when and weighing your loss and wins. That was really helpful.
I feel like it was really interesting when he was talking about holding people accountable for like the things they've said. Like he gave that example of the lady who thought he was like a delivery man and things, because I feel like there's been instances where people have said something and you kind of just want to let it slide just so you don't cause a fuss and things, whereas holding them accountable for it is more of a learning experience for them and anyone else who might have been around. So that was really interesting.
Wow, what an interesting discussion. Thank you so much, Wol, for speaking to us about that. There were so many moments that you spoke that you shared personal stories from your career or just things that happened to you that you shared with us, but also like the emotion and the wisdom that you gained through those experiences. So we felt that not only did we hear about that, but we learned a way that you dealt with those and how you're trying to work to improve things, especially with your 100 Black Interns campaign. So we really appreciate the fact that you spoke to us, and it was just really nice to hear your perspective coming as a leader in your field. We're a charity and we've got young people that are entering different fields of work. It was really nice that you literally spent the time to just educate us and give us your wisdom. We really appreciate that. And I want to say a massive thank you to the young people for jumping in on this call, asking some really focused, intelligent questions, and also just being there for the discussion. I think it was really nice just taking part and listening to that together. And I was really excited to share this episode with the listeners at home. So please do get in touch and tell us what you think about this episode. Tell us your favorite parts, and also tell us if we get Wol back what you'd like us to ask him, because we've got 100 questions on that list already, and I think we're going to need to do that. We're going to need to invite him back. Hopefully you'll have the time to do it. But overall, what a really nice sharing, learning experience. And the only thing that would really help us is if you could share awareness of our podcast and our charity. So if you could go to social media, you can find us at RF_tweets on Twitter, Renaissance Foundation on Instagram, and Renaissance Foundation GB on Facebook. Also, our website is renaissance-foundation.com. You can see all the social media links there, some activities that we've been up to recently in our COVID update, and most importantly, you can see how to donate and support us and the young people that we're helping to overcome significant challenges.